This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. On Monday, Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law the state's new congressional district map approved by lawmakers in last week's special session of the Florida Legislature. The new map, provided by DeSantis, aims to increase the number of Florida's U.S. House seats held by Republicans in a broader mid-decade redistricting effort sparked by President Donald Trump to help the GOP maintain control of Congress after this year's midterm elections. Just hours later, though, legal challenges to the maps began to be filed by voting rights organizations hoping to invalidate the maps. They argue the new maps are overtly partisan and as such violate the fair district amendments voters enshrined in the state constitution back in 2010. Supporters of Florida's new congressional map point to last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that strikes down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act that enabled the crafting of minority access districts. They argue that Florida's racial redistricting standards conflict with the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause and that the state's fair district amendments themselves are unconstitutional. With midterm primary elections already underway in some states, what will Florida's new congressional map and the subsequent legal challenges filed against it mean for candidates and voters this year? And why have lawmakers still not passed a budget for the state's fiscal year that begins July 1st? And whatever happened with property tax reform? Joining me now to explore these questions is Florida Gulf Coast University political science professor Dr. Sandra Pavelka. She's the founding director of the Institute for Youth and Justice Studies at FGCU and has past experience working for the U.S. Congress and the Florida Legislature. Sandra, welcome back.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
And joining us virtually is political scientist and assistant director of the University of Central Florida's School of Politics, Security, and International Affairs, Dr. Aubrey Jewett. Always great to connect with you, Dr. Jewett. Thanks for coming back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on today.
So before we dive into congressional redistricting, last week's special session was also called to address Governor DeSantis' priorities of an artificial intelligence bill of rights and a measure intended to carve out additional exceptions to public school vaccine mandates for parents to claim for their kids. Now, in this year's regular session, the Senate passed those bills. The House didn't even take them up. Dr. Jewett, were you surprised or perhaps just confused, as I was, as to why these bills would be revisited in a special session when less than a month earlier, House leadership had already made their position on it pretty clear?
Well, I think Governor DeSantis was once again trying to put his stamp on policy and establish his legacy. And probably more important than looking back at his legacy is to prepare himself for a future run for office. You know, he's term limited out. He's considered a lame duck. And the Florida legislature, particularly the House, has stood up to him on a number of occasions in the last 2 years. And so I think he believed maybe if he really pushed these two issues, the AI Bill of Rights and the Medical Freedom Bill, that maybe the House, when there was the glare of the spotlight and they knew that maybe a lot of Republicans in the base wanted these things, that maybe there'd be a different result. But Speaker of the House, Daniel Perez, basically squashed that very quickly by saying, look, we just are not going to take these up. We are going to take up the map, but we're not even going to take up these other things. They're just dead. And so, yeah, in the end, I think that's what DeSantis was trying to do, but Speaker Perez stood up for the prerogatives of the House.
Yeah. And moving on to redistricting, can we break down just precisely what the governor and Republicans in the legislature who voted in favor of this new map intend for it to do in the midterm elections? And Dr. Pavelka, I'll let you take the lead on this one.
Oh, absolutely. So this is unprecedented. We usually don't see mid-decade redistricting adjustments. You know, as we know, every 10 years that we see congressional districts redrawn based on population and the census. But this is something, obviously, that various states within the country have been dealing with. And the Florida legislature just approved this new map last week. And it really gives the Republicans up to 4 additional U.S. House seats and also then kind of readjust some of the historical Democratic leaning districts, for example, in Orlando, Tampa, and Broward County, and really has a minimal kind of impact on Southwest Florida and Lee, Collier, and Charlotte.
Yeah, so our area not really impacted, but specifically, it looks like Democratic-held districts 2 in South Florida, and 1 in Central Florida, and then 1 in the Tampa Bay area are the ones they're looking to flip from Democratic to Republican control. Dr. Jewett, since you're in Central Florida and one of those districts is in your neck of the woods, what do you know about Congressman Darren Soto's seat, its safety in Democratic hands, and what the congressman intends to do now?
Well, yeah, his seat before encompassed all of Osceola County, which is his home base, and then just part of Orange County, and it was fairly compact. And it did lean at least somewhat Democratic. It wasn't extremely safe, but it did lean Democratic. Well, now they have divided up Osceola County into about 3 other districts, including one that stretches all the way down towards your neck of the woods, a little more central than you guys are at, but it really is a much more sprawling district, not compact at all. But it had the effect of splitting not just Democratic voters, but Hispanic voters in that district. It was a Hispanic majority district before, very close to it. And now, if you look at those 3 districts that they carved Osceola up in, the one that has the most Hispanics is like a third, maybe 36%. But Darren Soto has indicated he's just still going to run, and we'll see what happens. You know, there is some talk, some thought, that maybe some of these seats that were drawn to favor Republicans may be at risk. When I looked at some research that ran the numbers on all of these districts, there was about 7 of these new Republican districts that only went for Trump, say, between 10 and 15 points last time, which if there is a blue wave election here in Florida and Democrats do 10 to 15 points better, I mean, it's possible that Republicans may not win 4 more seats. I mean, they may not win any more seats if things were the best that could possibly go for Democrats.
Yeah, I was looking at an analysis this morning from the nonprofit Civic Data and Research Institute that noted under the current system that we used to elect Congress members last time, Republicans had an average advantage of 20+ percentage points, but that with this new map, it could reduce that average overall advantage to just 8 percentage points. So as you were saying, seats that are comfortably in Republican control now could become much more competitive. Do you think, because I mean, we've been hearing even from Republican congressional members who were urging DeSantis not to pursue this, saying it could inadvertently end up hurting the Republican Party. Dr. Jewett, it sounds like there might be some merit to that argument. This isn't just being overly cautious.
Yeah, I think that's the case, because we've seen some neutral analysts. We've actually, you know, certainly some Democratic-leaning analysts, but we've seen several Republican-leaning analysts who have said, you know, you need to be very careful. In fact, they were sort of arguing against doing it, but you know, Governor DeSantis, again, thinking of legacy, thinking of maybe running for president again someday, is trying to be remembered as somebody who did all he could to help President Trump when President Trump asked Republican states to create more Republican-leaning districts. And so I think he just rolled the dice and said, look, we're just going to do what we can with this map to help Republicans. And then that's it. We know it's a little bit of a roll of the dice, but we'll see what happens. And the fact of the matter is, when you create a bunch more Republican seats, you have to add some Democratic voters to them. They did a pretty good job of stacking the 4 remaining seats with a lot of Democrats, but there is a number of Republican seats that I won't say that they're just competitive, like within 2 or 3 points. But again, if you only won by 10 and you look at the average over performance by Democrats in a number of special elections since the last presidential election, they've been doing 10 to 15 points better in many, many races. So, yeah, Republicans should not take this for granted, just assuming the map even, you know, withstands legal challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also want to add, I mean, today is going to be a real political test as we see 3 states that have elections in Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. And we see, you know, a decrease in economic confidence and concerns with the war in Iran and increased prices of, you know, grocery prices and gas prices. So we'll definitely see the Republicans being tested today. And that may obviously be some type of foreshadowing for the Florida election as well.
In that same vein, Dr. Pavelka, I've been hearing the same things you are. I heard on NPR this morning, you know, a reporter walking around with a state senator in Indiana saying, nobody's asking me about redistricting. They're asking me about affordability. That's their main issue. Are we seeing that same thing among Florida voters as well, where there may be a bit of a disconnect between the priorities of the Republican Party at this time and the priorities of, you know, the residents of Florida and just the struggles with their lived day-to-day experiences?
Absolutely. I mean, this is actually a continuing struggle. There is this disconnect, and it doesn't seem that the governor and the legislature are listening really to the, you know, to the voters and to the residents. And these are really concerns that continue to be kind of voiced by our voters. And it doesn't seem like the politicians, the elected officials, are listening, and people are struggling, and something really needs to be done about it.
Do you think that Governor DeSantis's willingness to take on this redistricting effort in the first place, kind of at the behest of President Trump, might be motivated by, you know, as we've already noted, he is a lame duck governor. This is his last year in office. He's looking at what his next move politically is going to be. It's been reported in, well, Newsmax, so take the source for what you will, that Trump was open to possibly considering DeSantis for a cabinet position after his time in the governor's office is over.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that could be a possibility. This has been a priority of the Trump administration. And Governor DeSantis is looking for his legacy, but he's also probably looking for his next, right? So is that a future cabinet position? Is a future run for Senate, for president? Really, those are some possibilities.
I want to note also there's been, you know, a bit of infighting within the Republican Party. You know, the vote to approve the congressional district maps was almost along party lines. There was just a handful of Republicans in the Senate who broke rank and voted against them. And that on top of some of the members of Congress from the Republican Party who didn't want them to do this at all. But on the other side, now that the maps have been voted into place, are we also maybe seeing a little bit of Democratic infighting? And by that, I'm pointing to Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She's been representing parts of South Florida since 2005. Her current District 25 is one of those targeted with this new map as really being at risk. And when asked if she'd run this year, she was kind of noncommittal. Meanwhile, the Black Democratic Caucus of Broward County's message to Wasserman Schultz yesterday was basically, run for any district you like, except for District 20. Now, that's the vacant congressional seat in South Florida that until very recently was held by Sheila Sherfulis McCormick. And, you know, there are interests in that area that want to keep that seat represented by a Black person, as it has been for more than three decades.
Yeah, and there's nothing like redistricting to create intra-party squabbles, not between the parties, but intra, like within a political party. And in this case, when you shrink from eight Democratic-leaning seats to just four, then particularly down in South Florida, where there was a number of these changes were made, then the existing incumbents, if they continue to want to run, they have to figure out, you know, what they're going to do. And for Wasserman Schultz, you know, this is a little bit of an issue. She's sort of the dean of the delegation down there. She's been around for a long time. She's pretty well known. But now, you know, her district that she's currently serving in was one that was carved up. And so she's got to figure it out. So Jared Moskowitz, same thing. You know, he's sort of considering this. He's looking maybe at trying to run in a district that has at least some overlap with his existing district, but maybe also a higher percentage of Jewish voters. And then, yeah, you've got several Black representatives, including, I think, for my generation from the good old Two Live Crew days, you know, Uncle Luke.
Yes.
Was thinking about running for Congress. And he's the one that sort of politely warned her, you know, don't run in this district. So
yeah.
It'd be interesting to see what they decide. From the Democratic Party perspective, I'm sure what Nikki Fried, who's the chair of the Democratic Party of Florida, she would probably really like it if they could all just sort of work this out informally and not have some bitter Democratic primaries that waste resources and gets voters upset and takes their eye off of being upset with DeSantis and Trump and instead being mad with their own people.
But this also, for congressional Democratic incumbents, this creates logistical issues too. Like, you can't just decide to run for a seat that seems like it's safer than another one? Like, there's residency requirements, right?
Actually, for congressional districts, the U.S. Constitution just says you have to be a resident of the state in which you run. So technically speaking, you don't actually have to live in the congressional district. There have been a number of occasions where people run for Congress and they don't actually live in the district. So, you know, sort of the old fashioned term would be they're sort of carpetbaggers. You know, they're running, they're a resident of the state, but they're not actually living in the district. So that actually is not an impediment to running as far as the congressional seats.
Interesting. So it's easier to run for Congress in Florida than it is to get in-state tuition rates at a state university.
Well, in terms of like having to live in the district, yeah, like I said, you do have to be a Florida resident. You do have to live in the state to run for Congress. You just don't necessarily have to live in the district. But that often does then become an issue for some voters, right? If it becomes clear that, again, you don't live in the district and you just seem to be running because for whatever reason, but not really because you have some deep knowledge of the residents that live there, that can actually, of course, work against you. But not always, because we have had some elected that way.
Yeah. I know this is a big question, but when it comes to the legal challenges that we began to see filed challenging this new congressional map yesterday, how do Florida's fair district amendments and the Supreme Court's decision last week on the Voting Rights Act come into play?
Well, obviously, I mean, fairness and competitiveness is so important in any election. And that, of course, relates to the Fair District Amendment. But when we're looking at the Louisiana strike down by the Supreme Court last week and now some options that have occurred in the Supreme Court here in the state of Florida, where there are a number of lawsuits that have been filed, the court really has some options where they can actually uphold the map. They can strike it down. They can strike parts of it down. They can order a temporary map, and they can also construct their own, which is kind of interesting, or send it back to the legislature to revise. So we'll definitely be seeing this legislative kind of jockeying and this judicial jockeying as we move forward.
You know, in the first legal challenges to the maps filed yesterday, it's this 71-page complaint. Now, I admit I haven't been able to read all 71 pages yet, but it called these new maps, quote, one of the most extreme gerrymanders in American history. What are your thoughts on that assessment? Is that hyperbolic or does that seem somewhat accurate?
Well, it's probably a little over the top, but it certainly was an egregious gerrymander. I mean, there's no question that it's a partisan gerrymander. In fact, usually that is the difficult part of the case, is proving that people had the intent to have a partisan gerrymander, because you can actually end up with a map that has a partisan gerrymander, but as long as you didn't intend to do it that way, it would technically be legal. But in this case, I mean, the governor's pretty much bragged about it. The main map drawer for the governor's office said that he used partisan data.
Yeah.
And in fact, the governor's office, the first map they released to anybody in the public, even before the legislature, was a map that was color-coded red and blue to Fox News. So that's like pretty much a clear indication. But what the governor and his team have argued, even in the letter of transmittal when they sent the maps to the legislature, was that Fair District's amendment should be just ruled unconstitutional completely. And that's because they say that it is in conflict with the U.S. Constitution and now this most recent U.S. Supreme Court decision about the Voting Rights Act. And of course, because Governor DeSantis has already appointed 6 of 7 members, there's a thought that there's a high probability that they are going to uphold the DeSantis map and they are going to completely strike down the Fair District's amendment. We don't know that for sure, but I will just also point out that, again, this was in the transmittal letter as well. They reminded the legislature that in the previous lawsuit from the 2022 districts, when DeSantis, you know, vetoed the original legislative map and then replaced it with his own, and eventually it went to the courts, when they upheld that, they said that there was a part of Fair Districts that said you're not allowed to diminish minority representation. And they said, well, that's clearly gone because we agree that this African-American district in North Florida is unconstitutional. Thus, you can diminish it. And the key for Fair Districts overall was that one of the justices sort of speculated, well, if this section about diminishing is no longer in effect, and we just say that this was voted on as a package by Florida voters, then we have to speculate that maybe the whole thing goes down. And that's what DeSantis is arguing, not just for the diminishment, but they also are basically saying now that the U.S. Supreme Court has said you cannot take race into account when you draw these maps. That means that since Florida Fair Districts requires you to take race into account, then the whole thing should be shut down. I might add, I don't know as a legal argument that it's necessarily true, but that seems to be what the governor is angling for and counting on, because he's not trying to hide the fact at all that this is a partisan gerrymander. At one point, we thought he might try to pretend it wasn't, but
right.
Now it's pretty clear.
Right.
They are just stating that.
Well, and Dr. Jewett, you know, going back to that 2022 congressional redistricting you were just talking about regarding the minority access districts in North Florida, the first lawsuit that had been assigned to that case went to Circuit Judge J. Lee Marsh in Leon County Circuit Court. That's the judge that this first lawsuit in this new case has also been assigned to. And he had initially ruled that DeSantis's redrawn congressional districts were unconstitutional and ordered lawmakers to come up with another map. Now, at the end of the day, that decision was later overturned. But is that possibly a sign that these legal challenges might have some merit or might be able to convince some judges?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely have legal merit.
I mean,
if you just take it on face, I mean, I think it's 100% clear that this map violates the Fair Districts Amendment. And so for the circuit court judge last time around, and maybe even potentially this time around, perhaps they will rule in favor of the plaintiffs and say the map is unconstitutional. But then it goes up to the appeals court, which is chock full of DeSantis appointees. And then if it goes beyond that, it goes to the Florida Supreme Court, which again is chock full of DeSantis appointees. And probably the other thing really quick to mention is the timeline here is really short.
Yeah.
Because the governor, a lot of people think this maybe was part of the intentional strategy to wait until the last minute, relatively speaking, to pass these maps. They actually already had to change the filing deadlines because they usually would have already occurred, and they've now pushed them to early June. So there's really like a month to figure all of this out. And so as Sandra was saying, the courts, particularly the Florida Supreme Court, if they get involved, they could just say, one way they actually could allow the maps to be used without making a ruling is to say, look, we will allow the court battles to continue. And while the court case goes on, though the maps can be used for this election. And that's what happened in 2022. Ultimately, they did say, okay, well, let the court case roll on, but we are going to use these new maps until such time as we make a definitive ruling.
And those took more than a year to resolve. So it sounds like while it is technically possible these legal challenges could have some impact on the midterm elections, it doesn't seem very likely at all. We're going to have this map going in.
I'm not really a betting man, but if I had to bet,
right.
I would bet that either the Florida Supreme Court will just strike down fair districts and uphold them very quickly, or at a minimum, they'll just sort of allow these maps to be used while the judicial battle rolls on. That would be my guess. Doesn't mean I'm right, and it's still possible that the maps could be stopped. So I don't want to, I don't have any insider information, but it just seems to me that's the most likely outcome.
It wouldn't be the first time that the comings and goings of Florida politics have caught me off guard. That's true.
That's for sure.
Well, Dr. Pavelka, looking beyond redistricting, Florida lawmakers still haven't passed a balanced budget for the coming fiscal year. What is going on?
No, we have not seen a budget yet. Obviously, they have until July 1st when the new fiscal year starts in the state of Florida. But as per the Florida Constitution, that's the only thing the Florida legislature has to do during a session, and they have yet to come up with a budget. As you mentioned earlier, the priority early on was property taxes and kind of getting rid of the property taxes for homeowners. But we haven't seen any really movement with that either. So we'll probably see another special session, and the legislature will be addressing that during special session prior to July 1.
All right. And I think that's set for actually to start next week.
Mm-hmm,
there's an 18-day
mm-hmm.
session on the calendar. Dr. Jewett, do you have any insights as to what the holdup might be in terms of why the House and Senate weren't able to come to an agreement on a budget during the regular session, and why even now we haven't heard much in terms of progress between the two chambers in reaching an agreement?
Well, the big picture was that the Senate wanted to spend a little more than the House overall. And then in some particular policy areas, there was still disagreement. So the good news is that at least the House Speaker and Senate President have agreed on the top line. And bottom line is actually going to be just a little bit less than the current budget years. And that's what the House wanted. They wanted a more strict budget. But now it's just a matter of the top lines on all the major policy areas. And so like education and health and welfare typically are the two that have the biggest battles because those are the two largest areas in the budget. And so I think that's probably where the holdup is. And I'm sure in both cases, the House is probably trying to spend a little less than the Senate. I mean, they're all trying to spend a little less than they're spending right now, but it's a matter of the degree of the cut. And just when we were talking about Speaker Perez continually standing up to Governor DeSantis on a number of issues, well, you know, this just goes to show he also stands up for the House and in terms of the Senate, because he hasn't seemed to want to compromise too much. Although, again, the good news is it looks like they're moving forward slowly but surely.
All right. And finally, Governor DeSantis is still speaking pretty confidently about the notion that the legislature will convene perhaps yet another special session to deal with property taxes. Dr. Pavelko, what's the latest on this that you're aware of?
I really haven't heard much, in all honesty. Aubrey might have, but it seems like, you know, the priority following the session was the redistricting. They have that kind of, you know, behind them, and of course, pending any court results, court decisions. But you would think that, you know, the property taxes would, because it was such a priority in the last session and moving out of the legislative session this year, that they would have really moved forward with some plan. So I'm sure there's a plan behind the scenes, but I haven't really heard anything that has been written or discussed on the media.
What about you, Dr. Jewett? Any idea what might be happening there? I mean, and I'm thinking of a conversation I had with the Lee County property appraiser and former state lawmaker Matt Caldwell back in January before the session even started. And of course, I'm not going to hold him to this because so much has happened since January. But he had predicted back then that this property tax reduction or elimination issue is not something they were going to be able to get done within a year.
Well, yeah. And so far, they haven't, right? I mean, the House actually has held hearings and they came up with about 8 or 10 proposals at one point and then narrowed it down to 1 or 2. But the Senate never moved on anything. And the governor's talked a good game, I will say. He's really talked a good game, but he hasn't taken any action. As again, the House Speaker has pointed out on numerous occasions, the governor has never yet provided a detailed plan. Having said all that, I'll be a little surprised if they don't end up putting something on the ballot, because typically Republicans agree on keeping taxes low and cutting taxes. I mean, that's sort of the glue that has always held the Republican Party together since Reagan. There's a bunch of other factions, but that's the one thing. And so I would predict that it would be something along the lines of, you know, over a decade, they will slowly cut the property tax for homesteaded properties, not for education, but for everything else. And that's something that they might put on the ballot. I could be wrong, but I won't be surprised if something like that goes on the ballot. I don't think they can just summarily cut it like in a real short period of time. I mean, they could put it on the ballot, but I don't think that would pass. But maybe something that was over time. Or the other secondary thing that maybe is also likely, I think, is just a big increase in the homestead exemption. Because then that way you might say, look, we're trying to go and help low-income people and seniors that are on fixed incomes. And so we will make sure maybe they don't have to pay as much. But this still means middle and especially upper-income people are still helping to pay taxes to provide the local services. So I think that might also be something that they put on the ballot in lieu of an actual elimination.
Yeah, and Aubrey, I agree with you. I think that obviously the impact on local government is going to be really substantial and something that the local governments, I think, are jockeying, you know, to figure out what they need to do in terms of assessments and fees if this does kind of happen. And time's ticking, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're moving forward. Time never stops. And the elections are nearing quicker than we know.
Well, in the spirit of time ticking, that is all the time we have for today's program. But I want to thank my guest. You like that segue. I've been speaking with political science professors Dr. Sandra Pavelka here at Florida Gulf Coast University and Dr. Aubrey Jewett with the University of Central Florida. Thanks, as always, to both of you for your time and your insights.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And if you missed any of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL, or subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.